KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today, I'm excited to have on the show Professor Greg Lestauka of Rutgers University, author of the book Virtual Justice, The New Laws of Online Worlds. We have, from time to time on Hearsay Culture, discussed virtual worlds, more from a sociological context, but we have not actually focused an entire program on virtual worlds and their constructs. And Greg's book is designed to really lay the groundwork for a field of study on the regulation of online worlds. And we're thinking in current formats, things like Second Life, and there, but Greg's book takes a look at the history of virtual worlds, and it's not a historical work per se, but he looks at some of the virtual worlds that I, as a teenager and even younger, messed around with, the text-based worlds where one would type pick up keys versus the worlds that we have today that are very graphically stimulating and where the interaction is far more complex. Greg's book is ultimately a discussion of law and regulation, and as he points out, it's a study of not how the law itself is applied, but more a study of what the law should look like. And he takes a look at various bodies of law, interestingly closing his discussion with intellectual property, which is something that we'll talk about as well as far as the structure. But to contextualize our discussion, Greg writes in his conclusion, what those, and this is a quote, what those visiting virtual worlds will find legally is something that resembles a new feudal order with separate and different sets of rules governing their rights and duties. Virtual sovereigns are minting their own currencies, crafting and drawing wealth from their own societies, fine-tuning their own economies, and casting out those who dare to flaunt their decrees. All of this suggests that virtual worlds are becoming, in essence, separate jurisdictions governed by separate rules. As a matter of legal doctrine, these rules may not qualify as laws, given that no territorial government has recognized the formal sovereignty of virtual worlds. But as a matter of effective legal practice, the doctrines of contract, property, hacking, and intellectual property all serve to greatly empower those who own and administer virtual worlds, effectively insulating their actions from legal review. And that gives a good summation of the ground that's covered in the book, and ultimately allows us to begin our discussion of virtual justice, the new laws of online worlds, with Professor Greg Lestauka of Rutgers University Law School. Greg is joining us by Skype from his home in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. Greg, thanks for joining us at Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having me here, Dave.
Let's start off with a question that I ask most of the authors I have on the show, which is your background. Your background and how you became interested in this topic.
So that's a long story, but
we have the time.
I'm happy to give it a shot here and try to make it brief. So I think, like a lot of people, I was always interested as a kid in science fiction and virtual reality. And video games. I played a lot of video games during my youth, and I think some of that actually shows up in the history section of the book. But I carried it forward with me a little bit more than most kids. I programmed my Apple II to play video games, and actually sold at a very small scale. Sold games in a kind of amateur computing magazine. And then when I went to college, actually, I think some people would work in Washington or professional jobs, but I worked on the New Jersey boardwalk as a arcade attendant and skee-ball mechanic. And part of that was just my interest in that whole scene. So fast forward from my misspent youth to law school at University of Virginia, and in 1999 or so, I was a research assistant for John Satir at UVA, and I wrote a web page about war games. I also encountered My Tiny Life, a book by Julian DeBell, and I also took some classes in cyber law, and I started to see that there was potential issue here in virtual worlds with the economies based upon virtual properties in the absence of any really good law controlling legal issues involving virtual property. And then fast forward again to 2002, when I made the acquaintance of Dan Hunter at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Dan emailed me after a Philadelphia area meeting and said, it seems like you're interested in virtual worlds. Do you want to talk with me about these things? We ended up actually working together on a paper that came out in the California Law Review, The Laws of the Virtual Worlds. I think originally when we both wrote it, we were just writing it because we thought it was a fascinating topic, but we didn't really expect it to be more than a one-off affair. But it turned out that subsequently, you know, in the following years, it did turn into quite a legal topic. I think there's a couple hundred law review articles now about virtual world issues. And also at about the same time that we wrote the paper, Dan and I started a weblog called Terra Nova with Julian DeBell and with Ted Castronova, who's famous for his economic studies of virtual worlds. And we actually added some other amazing contributors like Richard Bartle, who was the author, co-author of the first MUD, T.L. Taylor, and many others. And at about the same time, Beth Novick started a series of conferences, the State of Play conferences, that were bringing people together to talk about law and virtual worlds. Lawyers, but also others from academia, sociologists, anthropologists, game developers, and the whole thing sort of took off. It was only a couple years ago that I decided that there was enough material there to write a book. And so essentially the book kind of collects 7 years of studying the area, and that was kind of, you know, how I got to this point.
The in order to have the discussion, and for those, because I don't want people to lose us in the first few minutes as they say, well, I have no idea what a virtual world is, so I don't know what they're talking about. What is a virtual world? What do you mean by that phrase?
Well, I actually, you know, it's a good question, because when people say virtual world, they will sometimes mean the internet generally, or something like Second Life, but not something like a massively multiplayer online game. So I do offer a specific definition in the book that tracks what I think the people who study, and there's actually a growing number of people that are studying virtual worlds in all kind of disciplines. And my definition is that they are persistent, interactive, simulated social places where users employ avatars. And I think that the key, you know, kind of elements of that definition to focus on is that they're persistent, that if you make a change in a virtual world, it persists. If you come back, you know, a few months later, that change should still be there unless it's been changed, you know, subsequently by someone else. So it's like a persistent database. Also that it's social, that these are collaborative, you know, forms of social software. And the avatar, I think, is very important, that there is a kind of user embodiment within the virtual space where your avatar actually represents you to the society that's using the platform.
To, again, just to contextualize a discussion for those that aren't familiar, the avatars themselves, how are they created? How does one join a online world and create an avatar?
Well, so there's a variety of online worlds today. So if you take my definition that it's essentially persistent, you know, simulation where users interact with each other through the form of avatars, there's a lot of things that, you know, a lot of different virtual worlds out there that can fall into that category. So, for instance, Second Life and There.com would be virtual worlds, considered virtual worlds. A text-based MUD should be considered a virtual world.
And because, what is a MUD, just again, for clarity?
Yeah, right. So a MUD is basically where this all started. It's a virtual world that's constructed not of images, but of text. So you essentially, you log on to a MUD, and it provides you a description of the room that you're standing in, a description of the other avatars that are in the room, and then you can act, you know, on objects in the room and change them and change the database through textual commands. So it's essentially, you know, like any other form of virtual world, it's an interactive simulation. It's just the constraint on MUDs is that they are text-based rather than image-based. So you have MUDs, you have Second Life in that genre of kind of social virtual worlds. You have massively multiplayer online role-playing games like World of Warcraft and EVE Online, where players assume fantasy personas and basically play a game where the goal is to amass greater power and, you know, overcome obstacles. Then you also have a growing segment of virtual worlds that are targeted at children. So there's virtual worlds like Club Penguin, for instance, where kids have penguin avatars and interact with each other and acquire coins and try to build bigger igloos and get more furniture. And then you have also a growing number of sort of app virtual worlds like Farmville, which runs on the Facebook platform. And it's a very light virtual world in that it's not extremely detailed in terms of its graphics or its complexity. But it is a virtual world in that you have an avatar, you have a simulated place, and you have social interaction on the platform. So they have all sorts of different facets. And the creation of the avatar is usually like first step in any virtual world. Some of these virtual worlds, you need to purchase the software in order to log on and start playing. Some of the virtual worlds you need to purchase a subscription to the virtual world and pay every month to the game owner to play in the virtual world or to use the virtual world. But some of them are actually, you know, free and open to the public without subscriptions or without purchasing the software. And they have other revenue models. For instance, there might be micropayments. So in order to get ahead in the virtual world or, you know, accomplish certain tasks, you need to make small payments to the game company. Or they might be advertising based. So Coca-Cola, you know, had a virtual world. I'm not sure if it's still out there. But the idea is an advertiser creates a virtual world just to attract people to basically interact with advertisements for its product.
The book itself and the subtitle, The New Laws of Online Worlds, leads to a follow-up question, which is why you chose to write this book now.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I like I said, when Dan and I first started writing about the topic back in 2002, virtual worlds were fascinating at that time. I think just as fascinating as they are now. But there were not very many large-scale virtual worlds. I think EverQuest was sort of a market leader, and they had about 300,000 subscribers around 2002. What has happened since then is that virtual worlds have really taken off. So Farmville, in the space of a year, acquired about 60 million users of that platform. World of Warcraft has 12 million users. They're even bigger in Asia than they are here in the United States, and they're taking off in Europe as well. So just in the past 7 years, it's been an explosion of interest in this technology. And I think that, you know, originally, if I thought if this was a niche phenomenon that most people weren't aware of, they're probably, you know, it'd probably warrant a law review article or two. But given the increasing popularity of the technology, I think it's becoming increasingly important to society. We probably have conservatively 100 million people using virtual worlds. If I were to be less conservative, it might be 300 million. The numbers can be a little bit difficult to pin down, given that these are private companies and they don't have any obligation to let other people know what their subscriber numbers are, and sometimes have a, you know, an incentive even to inflate their subscriber numbers. But still, it seems to be a growing phenomenon that's becoming, you know, increasingly popular every year. And I think for that reason, I thought, given the legal interest in this, given the popular interest in this, a book is warranted on the legal aspects of virtual worlds.
Is there any, and we're chatting with Professor Greg Lestauka of Rutgers University Law School, author of the book Virtual Justice. Greg, is there any demographic data that we have on who these 100 million people are. I mean, I'm sure we could surmise, and I'm sure the stereotype would be, you know, the geeky nerd with the computer. But I imagine that the data would suggest that it's broader than that. Is there any demographic data? I mean, given the shortcomings of getting the information from the operators of virtual worlds, as you mentioned, is there any demographic data that exists? And if so, what does it tell us?
Yeah, there are some people that are looking into this, and some companies that have been willing to share some of this information. So there was a recent study done of EverQuest 2 users, and I think, you know, EverQuest 2 is your typical Dungeons and Dragons type role-playing game, you know, with elves and wizards, you know, walking around in an environment populated with, you know, dragons and fantastic castles. So I think the stereotypical, you know, assumption would be that, well, this must be something that's very popular with teenage boys. So the average player is probably, you know, in their parents' basement somewhere playing this, and it's an antisocial, you know, young boy. But what the survey showed was that the average age of an EverQuest 2 player is actually 30 years old, and that the average income of the players was $80,000. And they also did some, you know, interesting data gathering about the health of the players, and they found that actually most of your EverQuest 2 players are more physically fit than the general population. So these are achievement-oriented, you know, usually well-adapted, successful adults playing in this particular virtual world. Now, I mean, that's certainly not the characteristics of the average player of Club Penguin, I would hope. But it just shows you that you can't make stereotypical assumptions about the audience for these, you know, new forms of media. There's probably a wide range of demographics, and you know, there's I think the set of Farmville users is probably skewed, I would imagine, from my personal experience, you know, could be skewed female more than male. I don't think you should just jump to a conclusion about this being mostly media that's for kids. It's actually for adults as well. Second Life also as well. I think that's something that appeals particularly to adults and not so much to children.
And that's what gets us. I mean, that question gets us to one last background question before we talk in more detail about your book. As you mentioned, these virtual worlds are operated by for-profit entities. Unless I'm wrong about that, these are entities looking to ultimately turn a profit as their primary goal, as opposed to what a nonprofit might do. Does that reality impact the operation of virtual worlds? In other words, these are money-making businesses. And does that impact our understanding of what an online world is?
Yeah, I think it certainly does. I mean, some interesting things happened with MUDs in the 1990s, but MUDs were often fairly cheap to create, and some of the people creating them were doing it, you know, on a nonprofit basis as experiments. So, I mean, there were certainly commercial MUDs out there, but I think there was a sense where these could be platforms for political experimentation. But the contemporary virtual worlds, you know, Disney's Club Penguin or, you know, Blizzard's World of Warcraft or in Linden Lab and Second Life, they're definitely for-profit companies. So they've got to be looking constantly to their revenue models and how to monetize their user base. So they're really no different than Facebook or Google in terms of their business orientation. And so I think that you need to see the average user of a virtual world as being a consumer, you know, dealing with a business in basically the same way that you'd see any kind of basic internet user dealing with Facebook or Google as a consumer working with a business. So I think there's a misconception sometimes that that users of virtual worlds have some kind of political voice when I don't think they have much more political voice than the average visitor to Disney World has a political voice there.
With regard to the structure of the book, and it's something I mentioned in the introduction, I think it's useful to talk about up front. You cover and discuss intellectual property at the end of the book, and you have some interesting reasons for that that I thought you might talk about. Why discuss IP at the end? Because at least and certainly perhaps I have a little bit of a myopic view as an IP law professor and former practitioner. But the IP issues are rife here, and yet you discuss them towards the end after discussing a variety of other substantive areas of law and regulation. So why that structure?
Well, it's interesting. When I first started talking to lawyers and law professors about virtual worlds, the reaction I got sometimes was that, in terms of virtual property sales, there was a misconception that the issue with the sale of a piece of virtual property was essentially a trademark or a copyright issue. That because the claim was based upon a right to something intangible, that the appropriate area of law for dealing with this situation was intellectual property. But if you understand copyright and trademark law fairly well, what's interesting is that virtual property markets, these virtual economies, really are not about virtual property, are really not about intellectual property as a doctrinal matter, in that the seller of a virtual chattel and the buyer of a virtual chattel aren't really engaged in activity that triggers any kind of special copyright concerns or trademark concerns. Not that those cannot come up, but generally they shouldn't come up in your average virtual world, in your average real money trade situation. So there was a misconception that that all of this is already resolved by copyright law or by some other intellectual property regime, and it's really not. But at the same time, copyright law is extremely important to virtual environments, and it's important in a way that I think is really not entirely consistent with the purposes of copyright law. And, as I described in the last chapter of the book, the copyright interest allows the owner of the virtual world platform to use that interest as a lever to control user interactions with the environment. And this really comes up in the MDY versus Blizzard litigation, where Blizzard Entertainment is basically using copyright law as a lever to prevent the use of bots on the World of Warcraft virtual world. And the bots are thought to be useful for gold farming. So I really see copyright law being used as a lever to prevent gold farming. And I mean, the whole virtual world environment is all creatively coded software. So copyright law issues become incredibly complex when they're encountered in virtual worlds. And my decision to put copyright at the end of the book was based upon my belief that in some ways, the primary issues here are issues about governance and about the importance of contractual rules, the deference that we give to games. And even though copyright law is very important, if I had started with that, I probably would have never ended talking about copyright issues in virtual worlds. So I tried to hold off until the last chapter before going into copyright.
So almost building up the suspense for the IP nerds out there reading your book.
The interesting thing is I think there's so many fascinating issues that are not copyright issues in virtual worlds. And there's so many, kind of interesting questions about technological control over platforms and control over over software and how that influences the shaping of society and the regulation of society. And I didn't want to make this, a book purely about copyright, especially given that, copyright, to some extent, the theory of copyright is not really making sense when it's applied to virtual worlds. It's extremely powerful, but I don't know if it's extremely coherent.
Well, I think you've given me an easy segue to say explain what's the disconnect between the theoretical underpinnings of copyright and virtual worlds in your view?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that virtual worlds are social software, you know, in the same way that MySpace or Facebook is social software. So people log on to virtual worlds, and part of what they do is create content for each other. So they create avatar costumes. That's what they talk about in City of Heroes. They entertain each other in various ways. In Second Life, they basically, you know, users basically built the world of Second Life. There was fairly little original content that was provided by the game company, by Linden Lab, other than the just general framework and the tools for the users to create content. And what is, you know, fascinating, I think, about this is that given the way the contracts are structured, usually when you log on to a virtual world, you are, you know, at the very least, giving the platform owner a non-exclusive license to basically do as they wish with the content that you create in the virtual world. So we have these kind of creative sandboxes where, you know, all that you make, you know, on the platform, you're basically licensing to the owner of the platform. In some of the virtual worlds, you're not just licensing it, you're outright assigning it. So, you know, welcome to our sandbox, you know, here's the tools, create what you want, and we will own it, and you won't. And I just think, you know, just to take that a step further, in some virtual worlds, as I talk about in the book, the platform owners are wary of giving users too many creative tools because they're afraid that by allowing users to create new content in the virtual world, they're going to be subject to secondary liability for copyright infringement. So rather than, you know, handing out software tools that encourage user creativity, you see some virtual world platforms saying, no, actually, we need to limit user creativity because we don't want to deal with the problems that intellectual property law will create for us, you know, if users decide to create potentially infringing content. So so that dynamic of, you know, platform owner and user, and the platform owner, you know, deciding whether or not to create tools, limiting, you know, in some cases, limiting the capabilities of users to create, seems to be inimical to me, you know, to the goals of copyright. Copyright should be about creating, you know, about encouraging more creativity. And here we have platforms where the owners of the platforms want to limit user creativity for fear of, you know, repercussions of copyright law. So so that's just one way, I think, in which copyright law is really out of sync with what's happening in virtual worlds.
And this is, of course, I mean, that's part of a larger trend, as you mentioned, that deals ultimately with what we're doing with copyright and how those incentives have been inverted. We're chatting with Professor Greg Lastowka of Rutgers University Law School, author of the book Virtual Justice, The New Laws of Online Worlds, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the station. Greg, let's turn more specifically to focus of your book. In terms of, and you started talking about, in terms of how virtual worlds are currently regulated, how would you describe the system of regulation that we have?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to contrast, you know, I think part of my claim in the book is somewhat paradoxical in that I say that these are essentially becoming, in practical terms, their own jurisdictions. And there's a variety of reasons for that. I mean, we just talked about copyright law and the extent to which copyright law is essentially the law enabling copyright to be used as a tool for private regulation. So the copyright power that the owner of the platform has enables the owner of the platform to control, you know, to a large extent, to set limits on user behavior and user access to the virtual world. But additionally, hacking law, contract law, property law, the law of games, there's many other legal doctrines that work to enable increased private control by the owner of the platform. So to some extent, you can say that the law is already, you know, acting on these environments and regulating them, but essentially the end result of that regulation is to enable greater private control. So the result from the vantage point of the user of a virtual world is that if something happens to you, you know, in Second Life or in World of Warcraft, it really makes very little sense practically to look to a real world court for help, you know, to look to the legal system. It's expensive, you know, first of all, and often, you know, there are significant stakes, but maybe not significant enough to warrant litigation. And then, you know, additionally, there are all sorts of problems posed by, you know, finding out the identity, you know, of the person that's harmed you or defrauded you. So the smartest course of action is to not look to the legal system, but to look to the owner of the virtual world, to the game company or the platform company, and go to them with your problems, to submit a ticket. And then you have to basically confront what the rules are of that virtual world as the game owner is willing to enforce them. So sometimes a virtual world owner will set forth kind of community standards and say, all users have these sorts of duties to one another. And if anyone violates these rules, you should tell us, and they'll take an action like banning a user. For, you know, an improper, you know, assault, for instance, in Second Life. So essentially, the way that the law plays out is that it's not as if the, you know, existing law doesn't act on virtual worlds, but it acts to enable its private control. And when the users have problems in a virtual world, they go to the virtual world owner for justice. And, you know, that ties into the analogy with which I start the book, the institution of the castle in the Middle Ages, how the castle became a kind of technological power, but also enabled the people who controlled that power to basically make their own rules within their own small jurisdiction. And I think that's basically what's happening with virtual worlds, that the virtual world owners are controlling user interactions on their platform and setting the rules and meeting out justice, you know, on their terms.
Are there, in terms of how these owners of virtual worlds are creating these rules, again, I'll ask you, if based upon your research, where are these entities looking for guidance? Are they going to corporate HR policies, or are they going to the same law that you and I you know, talk about and teach in our classes? What is their, if you will, their muse for creating these regulations?
Well, so the, you know, as I explain in the, you know, in the book, the virtual world companies, I think, have two faces. The one they present to the user in the terms of service or the end user license agreement, and that face is rather unfriendly, I think, towards the users. So, for instance, I talked about the Second Life terms of service, which at the time of the Bragg case said basically we can terminate any user's account for any reason or for no reason at all. And that's, I guess, not too uncommon for internet services to use those kinds of terms. So the legal documents, the contractual documents, take a position towards the user that basically protects the game company as far as is enforceable under law. So the people drafting these agreements don't want to make sure that they're not unconscionable, But they want to give the game company every advantage they can get if a user has a claim that goes to a court, right? So they're written largely as protective documents. So that's the contractual status, and that, again, encourages, you know, greater private control, greater private power on the part of the game owner. At the same time, however, you know, a game company, a virtual world owner, is not going to want to adopt a tyrannical posture towards its consumers, you know, its user base. So I think game companies, when we're talking about the world outside the terms of service, which, you know, I think 1% of its users probably are going to read, they have an incentive to please their consumers to the extent that pleasing their consumers is profitable. And generally, it is, right? So so they have an incentive to listen to what their users want, to respect the user expectations, and actually to change their policies to adapt to whatever the emerging norms are in the environment. So the market, you know, dynamics will lead them to create mechanisms for users to kind of have their own norms enforced. But what I find, you know, kind of fascinating is the degree to which there might be a discrepancy between the legitimate interests of users and the norms of the online community and the willingness of the platform owner to, you know, enforce those norms in all situations. Because there will be some situations when there will be a disjuncture between what the, you know, what the company wants and finds profitable and what the users find desirable. And this is not a democratic system. Like I said, it's more of a feudal system where, you know, those with the technological and legal power can have the ability to lord it over those who are users of the platform. Normally they want to be benevolent dictators,
right?
But they will, I think, you know, in some cases say, look, in this particular situation, we're not willing to spend the money to resolve this dispute. You've got to deal with it yourself.
And one of the, and we're chatting with Greg Lestauka of Rutgers University Law School, author of the book Virtual Justice on KZSU and Hearsay Culture. Greg, one of the precepts, if you will, of cyber law that you take on and I think discuss in some detail in the book is the you know, the phrase or the saying that code is law. And you do a textual analysis of what that actually means and make the point that code or software is not law. So how is code or software not law in your view?
Right. Well, I think it's always been, you know, when other, you know, legal scholars write about code as law, they struggle with it because they're not exactly sure, you know, what it means. And I think that's because it means actually the opposite of what it says. So the phrase, I think, actually originates with William Mitchell, dean of architecture at the time he wrote the book at MIT. But of course, everyone associates it, I think, primarily with Larry Lessig, who really kind of expanded on that and wrote about it at length in his book, Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace. But if you look at what Lessig says, he does not say, you know, that that technology, code, software control, architectural control is the same as law. In fact, his point in code is that software control, software as a regulator, is importantly different than law in the sense that the, you know, he uses Microsoft as an example, also AOL, in his book Code. And the thought is that when a private company sets rules or essentially regulates society via software, there is no kind of constitutional system of checks and balances to make sure those rules reflect the interests of, you know, the greater public. And his argument in code is that we need more East Coast code tempering the expansion of West Coast code, which means we need more government intervention, basically stepping forward to control the power that's being created by these new forms of internet-based software. I think that's the theme of Code. So really, you know, the theme is Code is like law in that it can act to regulate society, but it has important deficits that make it unlike law in that it does, it's privately controlled, it has certain characteristics. It, for instance, Code works to prevent conduct usually before it can occur. It acts more like a wall that prevents you from stepping onto property than does the law, which is usually a remedy, you know, that says, look, there's a rule, and you can violate the rule, and then subsequently we'll you know, see if there's a there's been a violation of the law, and we'll provide some sort of remedy for that violation. So there are important differences. And I think, you know, so the idea that code is law as a mantra is actually, you know, kind of misguiding. It's kind of misleading mantra. The real point is that we need to pay careful attention to these sorts of flexible technologies that have the capacity to influence the way that we think and that we act. And we need to make sure that the values in these technology are the same civic values that we want to see always, you know, in our society. We don't want to cede too much control to the crafters of software. We want to make sure that they respect, you know, constitutional values and public values.
And we have about 12 minutes left, and I think that latter point leads to a follow-up question, which is that you discussed this topic, Greg, in your chapter entitled Hackers. Why does it come up, or how does it come up in that context? And perhaps I'll ask you along those lines, what do you mean by the name or the word hacker?
So, I mean, I'm very interested in hackers and hacking. And, you know, obviously, so Richard Stallman has a definition of hacking and hackers that I think is very different from what most people think of today. So today, I think people think of hackers as criminals that are, you know, stealing passwords online and breaking into computer systems, doing malicious things. And the word actually evolved from roots that were, I think, much more positive. So Steve Levy's book kind of characterizes hackers as heroes of the computer revolution, and that's you know, from the 1980s. So it seems like we've come, you know, a long way towards you know, in a shift in the meaning of the term. Although still there are some, you know, communities today that are pro hacker and see the word hacker as you know, a tinkerer or someone that comes up with clever solutions, and don't really use the word with its kind of criminal patina. So so the title for the chapter, I think, reflects the ambivalence of the term. And the reason that you know, I talk about hackers when I talk about code as law is that in virtual worlds, because code is so important as a regulatory force. So the software shapes what you look like. The software shapes who you can talk to. The software shapes, you know, where you can go, you know, the physics of the world. You know, so the software can change, and then in simulation, things can fall up instead of falling down. So the control over the technology and the platform, which is, you know, embodied in software, is something that, you know, can't be overstated, I think, with regard to virtual worlds. And the hacker is someone who takes the software rule and somehow breaks it. And I think it's really interesting to look at situations in virtual worlds where a user of the virtual world either exploits a, you know, a vulnerability in the software or breaks a software rule and in some way flaunts the you know, decree of the virtual world owner. I, you know, I have a few examples of that in the book. What's interesting to me is that in the in the fiction, the science fiction about hackers, usually the heroes of science fiction novels and movies are hackers, because they're the ones who have the ability to confront, you know, these cruel overlords. So think about Neo in The Matrix, or Flynn in Tron. All of these, you know, kind of classic science fiction hackers who are protagonists, or hero protagonists in Snow Crash. But in virtual worlds, what you see is actually something much more predictable, that these hackers are usually people interested in gaining power, personal power, through the exploitation of software, you know, loopholes and breaking restrictions in the code. And that, you know, when they can, given the importance of these virtual economies, they'll turn a profit from their ability to break the software. So the ability to, you know, find loopholes in the code, to exploit bugs, is fascinating to me, because it shows that users can resist, in a way, the power of the their kind of virtual overlords. But at the same time, we actually have a developed law in this area, and it's at least possible that computer hacking laws can apply to many of the forms of hacking in virtual worlds. So that's what the chapter is largely about.
I think we, in the last 6 or so minutes we have, we get to the unfair portion of the show, and unfair in the sense that I ask questions that can't be answered in the time left. And so I do my best to ask questions that are a little more narrow. And I'm going to try it out with this question. With regard to a specific area where the norms within virtual worlds may clearly differ from what we do outside of virtual worlds, one very interesting issue is privacy, and I think it's a good way to, in the last few minutes, explore where we go from here. You point out in the book that privacy issues abound because, for example, one can see through walls in a virtual world, and people are flying, which obviously we can't do. So how does one conceive a privacy right in a virtual world, and then how does that tie in broadly to these new laws that are the focus of the book?
Yeah, well, privacy online is such a huge issue and such a puzzling issue, I think, at this point, in that, you know, what is your expectation of privacy when you're using the internet? The use of cookies, you know, software tracking, data mining is huge and, you know, commercially important in the United States. So online privacy generally, I think, is a puzzle at this point, what the norms and expectations are. In virtual worlds, it's a puzzle squared, because you have sometimes users who might have an expectation of privacy, might feel, you know, that if you are in your own, you know, personal, you know, plot of land and Second Life, and you're inside your house, you know, within your walls, that you actually do have a private space. But as Josh Fairfield has pointed out in an article and pocket piece of the Yale Law Review, virtual worlds are, you know, completely panoptic, in the sense that in many virtual worlds, everything is recorded. All the data flows are recorded and logged. So if you are the owner of a virtual world, you could go and play back everything that's happened in your virtual world, you know, since the inception, and be, you know, at any point in the virtual world, if you set up the right kind of client software, to see what is happening. So everyone in a virtual world, you know, can be constantly monitored. It's only a question of whether the company wants to invest in the logging software to do that. So you might say that you have absolutely no expectation of privacy in a virtual world. And there are other privacy problems in virtual worlds that make them special. There's a question of privacy between, and Talzarski has written about this, there's a question of privacy between user and avatar. So you might say, in the virtual world, I want to, you know, be this other person that's not me in real life. And I don't want anyone to draw the connection between my real identity and my avatar identity. And people have sometimes a very strong interest in keeping those two kinds of selves separate, which, you know, to take it, you know, to a, you know, kind of a more common level, if you're in Facebook, for instance, you might not want your relatives to be getting the same information that your close friends are getting. And I think, you know, college students are always dealing with how to work Facebook right. to be able to bridge their social spheres. Well, it's something similar, I think, in virtual worlds. And actually, Blizzard encountered a problem with that when it decided that on its forums, it wanted users to actually have their real names associated with their avatars. And there was a huge outcry that users did not want that link to be drawn. And I think Blizzard was thinking that it was might be useful for essentially building out its own social software network to have real identities used in its forums. But in response to the outcry, it actually reversed itself and decided, okay, the users really don't want this. So it reinstituted the avatar names.
And, you know, and these challenges faced by entities operating virtual worlds leads us, I think, to what will be a last question for you, Greg. Again, you set up the book as what the law should look like, and I do think that the book does effectively establish a benchmark from which other scholars can further research. If you were to set a scholarship agenda for researchers in this area and to identify the top, let's say, two or three areas of necessary focus, again, unfair question, in 2 minutes, what would those be?
Well, so there's two aspects of that. So I got, I guess, 1 minute for each. The technology is developing in a way that social software on platforms is becoming more important. So social gaming, you know, and augmented reality gaming, I think, is kind of the wave of the future. And so I think the technology is shifting, and that's important to pay attention to. The thing that I, you know, think is really important and that I, you know, focus on in Chapter 6 is games. I think what we see in virtual worlds is a interest by players in doing things that are socially productive and you know, in investing in these platforms. But often this is kind of a broad kind of cultural creativity that can be harnessed for commercial purposes. And the book, to a certain extent, I think I'm following around Julian DeBell and trying to be a legal interpreter for some of the things he writes about. But something he's talked about recently is ludocapitalism, the idea that play and commercial, you know, profit and labor are kind of blending into each other. And I find that fascinating, and I think it has implications not just for virtual worlds, but for many other things that are going on the internet today. Amateur creativity, you know, being one of them. So, I think a focus on the relation between play and work, and between kind of intrinsic motivations and extrinsic motivations, commercial motivations, is something that really deserves more attention, and that's certainly present in the things that we're seeing coming up with virtual worlds.
The author is Greg Lestauka of the book Virtual Justice, The New Laws of Online Worlds. Greg, you have an interesting couple of modes of distribution of your book, and I think in about 30 seconds, how can people get your book and learn more about your work?
So you can buy the wood pulp version on Amazon.com or, you know, from the Yale Press website. There's a variety of ways to do that. Or you can go to my website and you can download a PDF version of the book. So it's a Creative Commons licensed BYNC 3.0. So feel free to take a look at it as a PDF or, you know, or just use it in that form, or to buy the wood pulp copy if you're interested.
And your web address is?
You should probably just Google Greg Lestauka. I can tell you.
Fair enough.
Long
fair enough. Yeah, Google's our entryway to the internet anyway. Yes. Greg Lestauka, author of the book Virtual Justice, New Laws of Online Worlds. Greg, thanks much for joining us on the show, and I invite you back to continue what has been a very interesting discussion.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up on the show that are going to round out, ultimately, our schedule for this quarter. Next week will be Professor Adrian Johns of the University of Chicago, author of the book Piracy. And at the end of the quarter, we will have Professor Nick Bostrom, the director of the Future Humanity Institute and professor at the University of Oxford. There are a number of guests coming up in the winter quarter that will begin at the end of the year. Among them are Ryan Kahlo, director of the Consumer Privacy Project at Stanford, Center for Internet Society, Associate Dean Mike Madison of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, Evgeny Morozov, a foreign policy and author of the book How Dictators Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Web, Professor Siva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia, author of the forthcoming book The Googleization of Everything, Professor Jennifer Urban, director of the Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic at UC Berkeley School of Law, Professor David Post of Temple University's Beasley School of Law, author of the book In Search of Jefferson's Moose, Notes from the State of Cyberspace. Professor Dan Hunter, Greg's partner in much of the research that led up to this book of New York Law School. Jame Cassio discussing his book Hacking the Earth. Professor Andy Hiley, my colleague at Elon University School of Law, discussing online sales taxation. Professor Dan Soliv of George Washington University Law School, author of Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. Professor Ramesh Srinivasan, Department of Information Studies and Design and Media Arts at the University of California, Los Angeles. And Kevin Paulson of Wired Magazine, author of Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the $1 billion Cybercrime Underground, coming out next year, as well as Professor John Taranian, a return guest from Chapman University School of Law. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show live on KZSU, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time, or you can pick up the show by going to hearsayculture.com as a podcast, by Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, and by going to the webpage for Stanford Center for Internet Society at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed the show, and please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. Have a great day.